Thank you very much for that kind introduction, Timothy. And let me also thank the Queensland branch of the Economic Society of Australia for hosting the event today. Thank you all for coming, and a special thanks also to Michael Knox, as well as to Tim, for their assistance in this event today. So I wanted to talk to you, as Tim said, about adjustments in the Australian labour market. The Australian economy has been growing at a moderate pace since commodity prices peaked around about 4 years ago. And while mining investment has declined substantially since then, and to my mind has further to fall, resource exports have grown strongly and are expected to do so for some time. Fiscal consolidation, meanwhile, at state and federal levels, that has weighed somewhat on growth. And the exchange rate has been relatively high compared to what one might have expected given these circumstances. At the same time, however, very low interest rates have been supporting demand. So there's been a range of these different forces affecting the economy. Overall, though, spare capacity in product and in labour markets has gradually increased. Since about 2011, the unemployment rate has risen from around 5% to about 6.25% towards the end of last year. Also, as you can see here, the participation rate and the ratio of employment to the working age population, those two things have fallen to relatively low levels. But in the face of significant structural change in the economy, the labour market, it has been adjusting more smoothly, at least over the past year, than we had been expecting. And when we put our forecast together earlier this year, we had expected moderate growth of economic activity for some time. The GDP growth, at least that has been recorded, suggests that we've been about right on this so far. And so we'd also thought at that time that this would lead to a further gradual increase in the unemployment rate and be accompanied by subdued growth of employment. If we have a look here, since then, the labour force data have been a bit better than expected. And while the unemployment rate certainly remains high, and if we look through the month-to-month volatility, which this chart tries to do by taking things in terms of a three-month moving average, so if we look through that volatility, I think we can say that the unemployment rate's been little changed since the latter part of last year. So this flat point here. And in addition to that, if we look at the lower panel, we can see that employment growth has picked up and has been running ahead of the growth in the working age population. So I think the question before us is how we can try to reconcile that better than expected labour market outcomes here with only moderate growth in GDP. And that's the focus of my talk today. And what I'm going to go through in my remarks is four possible explanations for this. So the first possibility is that the recently released data revealed that the population growth, and therefore the growth in the labour force, has been just a little bit lower than we had earlier assumed. And in the face of fewer employment opportunities over recent years, particularly in resource-related industries, there's been a decline in the number of immigrants arriving to Australia to seek work. And while we'd always expect the labour supply to respond to economic conditions in Australia relative to those overseas, I think the adjustment that we've seen has been just a bit more pronounced than had earlier been anticipated. So that's the first possibility. The second possibility is that wage growth has declined as spare capacity in the labour market increased. And this is also unsurprising, but the adjustment, the magnitude of that adjustment has been larger than suggested by historical experience. And I think this probably encouraged more employment growth than would have otherwise been the case and improved the cost competitiveness somewhat of Australian labour. It also has acted as a signal to encourage that adjustment in the supply of labour that I've just talked about. The third possibility that I want to explore is that the composition of growth may be playing a role in boosting the demand for labour. So even though aggregate economic activity, that's grown at a below average pace, what might have happened is that conditions in the labour-intensive parts of the economy, maybe they've improved. And then finally, the key source of data, the Labour Force Survey, the national accounts, they're both subject to measurement error and they're often revised. So it's just possible that the current data that we have before us, including in this chart, are providing a noisy signal of what's actually happening. So those are the four things that I'm going to go over in turn. And then I want to come back to a discussion of what the likely implications of those developments might be for the economic outlook. So let me turn to changes in population growth. As recently as May, official data that we had suggested that the working age population had been growing at about 1.7% per annum. And it was expected to continue at about that rate into the foreseeable future. However, the most recent data from the ABS, which is shown here, suggests that total population growth had dropped quite noticeably over the past year or so, from a local peak of about 1.8% here to about 1.4% over 2014. So 1.8 over 2012, 1.4 over 2014. And that's the population growth. Estimates of the working age population, they're expected to be revised down accordingly in the coming months when the ABS update that data to take account of this population, these population numbers. Now, the decline in the population growth, we don't know for sure, but it appears, certainly you can see here, it's the result of a decline in net immigration, but the exact components we don't yet know about fully. So what does appear to have happened is it does seem to be related to a weakening in Australia's labour market conditions relative to those of other countries. Now, of course, people on temporary skilled work visas, the so-called 457s, they would normally leave for home or jobs elsewhere in the world when their jobs here end. But there's also been a large decline in net immigration from New Zealand. Labour market conditions in New Zealand, they tightened at about the same time that spare capacity in the Australian labour market increased. The reconstruction activity in Christchurch took off around the time that construction in Australia's resource industries was winding down. And indeed, the key mining states of both Queensland and Western Australia, those are the states that have seen the largest declines in net immigration from overseas. It also appears that Australia's intake of international students has not picked up. So it's not picked up to the extent that was previously anticipated. Now, the unexpected slowdown in population growth, that implies somewhat less rapid growth of our labour force than would otherwise be the case. And that means that the GDP growth that we have recorded, that may have been a bit closer to the recent growth in the economy's productive capacity than we'd previously thought. So if that's the case, that would have left the economy with just a little bit less spare capacity, in other words, a lower unemployment rate than we had expected. Yet I think that this can only account for part of this unexpected adjustment in the labour market. Most notably, labour demand's picked up, and that's evident in that earlier rise I showed you in the employment to population ratio. So let me turn to the role of wage growth. One possible explanation for that pickup in labour demand relates to the very large decline in wage growth that we've seen over recent years. You can see that in the top panel, which is average earnings per hour from the national accounts. So over recent years, that's been relatively low. And indeed, the behaviour of wages during the current episode, that's been comparable to the experience that we saw round about the time or a little bit after the 1990s recession, which is really just to say this sort of growth in nominal wages wasn't sort of dissimilar to what we saw back here. And that's true of nominal wage growth shown in the top panel. It's also true in terms of growth in the cost of labour required to produce a unit of output, the unit labour cost, which is shown in green in the lower panel here. And the decline in real wage growth, that's also been of a similar magnitude to what was experienced in the early 1990s. Now, while we would normally expect wage growth to decline after a period of subdued labour demand that we've seen over recent years, the decline over this period has been larger than suggested by historical experience. And this chart tries to display that about as clearly as I think we can. In particular, what you can see here is that although the unemployment rate has increased by this amount, which is much less than was the experience during the 1990s recession, the drop in average earnings in wages from the time that the unemployment rate started to pick up has been about the same order of magnitude. So a big response in wage growth for a small increase in unemployment relative to the earlier experience. And there's a number of reasons why wage growth may have been so responsive this time around. Just to give you a few examples. The thing I'd start with is thinking about the boom in commodity prices and mining investment. When that was occurring, wage growth increased noticeably, and the exchange rate, it appreciated significantly. And what that did was leave wage costs in foreign currency terms quite high once those commodity prices had peaked. And then the subsequent fall in commodity prices, that was associated with relatively low growth of wages, lower growth in incomes over recent years, which alongside some depreciation of the nominal exchange rate, that's helping to restore earlier levels of competitiveness. Another possibility is that wages have become more flexible over time. It may be there's been some general shift in the bargaining power of labour. Also, it's true that those industries that have been most exposed to the declines in commodity prices and mining investment, those are the ones that tend to have a pretty high share of individual employment contracts. So they're a bit more flexible. And the other thing is that the relatively long span of the current episode, it's occurred over a number of years, means that most employment contracts have been renegotiated over the period of subpar economic growth that we've seen over these few recent years. So whatever the reason for the very low growth in labour costs, wage flexibility has assisted with the labour market adjustment. Changes in relative wages, they act as an incentive for labour to move, including across borders. Strong increases in wages in the resource sector, both in Aussie dollar terms, but also in foreign currency terms, that helped initially to attract the labour needed to undertake the very substantial increase in mining investment, including that labour coming in from overseas. And all of those sorts of things are now adjusting in the other direction. So the weaker wage growth and the decline in job opportunities relative to many other countries has probably contributed to the lower growth in the population and in the labour supply. But perhaps, at least as importantly, low wage growth across the economy has enabled firms to employ more labour than they otherwise would have. Even so, look, my sense is that low wage growth, that only goes some way to explain this recent pickup in the demand for labour. So let me turn to compositional change. So while aggregate GDP growth has been moderate, the composition of economic activity, that may have underpinned a rise in the demand for labour of late. Growth in consumption, dwelling investment and net service exports, the contribution from net service exports to GDP, all of those things have increased over the past year or so, even though GDP growth, if anything, has just eased back a touch, at least in year-ended terms, as you can see here. So it's quite a bit in this chart, and I'll take you through it slowly, but I guess a key point I wanted to make is that surveys of businesses, and this data shown here in green, business conditions, is from the NAB survey of businesses. So that survey suggests that firms providing services to households, for those firms, conditions have increased substantially from around the middle of 2013, and they have been well above average over the past couple of years. So you can see that they picked up here and then have stayed at a reasonably high level, if anything, just trended up a bit. Surveyed conditions are also above average for those firms providing business services. So we can see that here, although the improvement there has come from a lower point and has maybe been above average for a slightly less time than was the case for the household services sector. And meanwhile, overall conditions for firms producing or distributing goods, that's the last panel here, that's also, they remain a bit below average, but had been at even lower levels and low levels for quite a long time. So I think what's surprising perhaps is that those survey results from the businesses, that's NAB calling up businesses essentially, that marries reasonably well and lines up reasonably well with the employment growth across sectors, which comes from the ABS knocking on households' doors and finding out essentially where people are working. So if we go back just for 1 minute, we can see the employment in household services has been very strong. So that's over here on this axis. The cumulative increase has been pretty substantial over this period. That accords with this generally being above average. And the really, I think, surprising element when I first looked at this data was this period of softness here actually preceded and only was pretty closely followed by this period of weakness in the employment. So the business conditions were lining up with that soft patch in household services. But the overall message is very strong employment growth there, above average conditions. This period of weakness in employment in business services, which really peaked here around the time of the peak in the mining investment boom and then came off, that accords with this below average conditions as reported by the NAB survey in that sector, and this movement higher in employment has corresponded with this movement higher in business conditions, and it's been growing strongly in the last little while, consistent with above average conditions there. And then once the mining investment boom peaked, we see conditions had moved lower here. They've been improved a little bit overall, but we haven't seen much employment growth, and that's consistent with these conditions being below average, a bit below average for quite some time. And just as an interesting aside, let me show you this chart, which shows that essentially, well, what I wanted to say is the variation in business conditions and employment across those sectors I just showed you, that's consistent with the weakness I think we've seen in business investment. And so the services sector, service sectors on average have relatively low capital to labour ratios compared to those producing or distributing goods. So in order to satisfy increased demand for the services, firms in those sectors, they've hired more workers, but they don't need to invest much by way of machinery and equipment or buildings and structures compared with the firms in the goods producing sector. So here in the household sector, household services sector, on average, the value of the net capital stock per worker is about $100,000. Every worker's got about $100,000 worth of capital to work with. And compare that to the goods-related sector, where it's a bit under $400,000. So a lot of jobs created in this sector means you don't need so much investment, new investment, to supply those workers with new capital so they can do their jobs effectively. Anyway, this compositional change in demand towards more labour-intensive industries, that's part of a longer-running trend. I think there's also a cyclical element to it. As mining investment unwinds and the growth of dwelling investment and consumption, which is increasingly dominated by services, those things have picked up. Also, I should note the decline in the exchange rate, that's encouraged Australians and foreigners to direct more of their spending towards Australian-produced tourism, Australian education, and Australian business services. So those are my first sort of three possible explanations. I'll come to my fourth, which is measurement error. It's possible that the decline in population growth that we've seen, the very low wage growth, and the compositional change can explain much of the adjustments that we've seen in the data in the labour market, even though the growth of aggregate economic activity has remained moderate. But it's also possible that the picture before us of recent labour market outcomes and economic conditions more generally are being clouded by just the usual measurement difficulties. Now, there's naturally a degree of statistical noise in the labour force survey, as there is with any survey data. So it could be providing a noisy read of true labour market conditions. And while it's possible the labour force survey is overstating the true state of demand for workers at the moment, it's worth noting that the separate survey the ABS does of businesses' vacancies, which is shown here on the right-hand panel, it's broadly consistent with the improvement we've seen in the labour market demand of late. So vacancies have picked up for the nation as a whole since 2013, and most of that growth has been driven by New South Wales and Victoria, and most of it has been rising vacancies in the services sector, which you can see on the right-hand panel. Meanwhile, vacancies in Queensland and WA and vacancies for the goods sector, they've been relatively weak. So these different sources of data are telling a sort of similar type of story. Similarly, it's possible the national accounts data, the data that underpins the GDP growth estimates, that might be understating the growth of economic activity over the past year or so. Some research by my colleagues at the bank shows just how sizable those revisions can be. For example, if we just look at data since 1998, the first estimate that the ABS produces of year-end GDP growth has been revised on average by about a half a percentage point over subsequent years. So that could be operating, there could be errors there as well. The usual sorts of errors. Now, while we can't be sure of the recent past, more difficult still really is to know what the future holds. But let me try and say just a few words about the outlook. We've recently published an account of our latest economic forecasts in the August Statement on Monetary Policy. I don't want to repeat the details of those forecasts, but I do want to highlight the implications of the four issues I've just discussed. So changes in population growth. How do we think about that? Well, the implications of lower population growth for the outlook for spare capacity, that depends on the effect of population growth on both aggregate demand and aggregate supply. Lower population growth implies slightly less growth in aggregate demand for goods and services. So at the margin, what's going to be happening is there'll be not quite as many new residents coming in, and therefore not quite as much spending on items for consumption or to meet their housing needs, nor will there be quite as many new workers that we'd need otherwise to equip with capital to do their jobs, hence not quite as much investment growth. Now, despite the downward revisions to a number of those elements of aggregate demand, the unemployment rate we forecast the unemployment rate to be a little lower than we'd previously anticipated. In part, that owes to the slightly better starting point that I showed you at the outset in terms of the unemployment rate compared to what we'd earlier assumed. But it's also true that the unemployment rate is forecast to remain little changed from levels of recent months over the course of the rest of this year and into the next. And this is because the change in the growth of aggregate demand that I've talked about, that's expected to be more or less broadly matched by lower growth of the economy's productive capacity, and that in turn follows from a slightly lower growth in the labour force. So that's what we expect, but there's considerable uncertainty about both the rate of population growth and its effects on spare capacity. So let me just talk through a quick example here. It may be that the lower immigration may reflect a fall in the number of people coming to Australia who have a pretty high propensity to participate in the labour force. So New Zealand is, for example, of prime working age. In that case, the implication for the economy's productive capacity will be a bit larger than if the lower immigration was mostly due to fewer international students coming in who don't typically participate to the same degree. It's not clear whether these two groups would have the same effect on demand, though. Both they need to feed themselves, they need to clothe themselves, they need to house themselves. Both have different incomes, both have different propensities to save, and both have different propensities to spend. Now, another source of uncertainty affecting the outlook for supply is productivity growth. And that is especially hard to forecast at the best of times. What signal can we take from recent developments? Not much. That's my sense of things. Now, this is a bit tricky, but we know that the lower than expected population growth will by itself lead to a downward revision to employment growth when the ABS update their labour force for the new population numbers. So slightly less employment growth is on the cards. And for the given growth in GDP that we've recorded, what does that mean? Well, it means this implies existing estimates of recent productivity growth are somewhat understated. So we can expect those productivity growth numbers to be revised up just a little when the ABS employ that revise their employment growth numbers. However, recent measures of productivity growth, they tend to provide just a very noisy signal of future productivity growth. So we haven't really changed our view on productivity growth in light of all of this. We assume it's going to be around its long-run historical average. Let me turn to the role of wage growth. What about the relevance of that for the economic outlook? Well, I think a reasonable starting point is to be concerned that low wage growth might weigh on labour income, thereby weakening the outlook for aggregate demand. But that's really an incomplete description of a much more complicated process. In particular, wages tend to lag the business cycle. They don't tend to lead it. And I think that makes sense for two reasons, right? First, many wages are determined by fixed-term agreements, so they take some time to adjust to changing economic conditions in the labour market. And second, even after the growth of output picks up, which is what we're forecasting to occur gradually, it can take time to absorb the spare capacity that's there in the labour market and hence for wage pressures to build up. So given this, the low wage growth of recent years, I think, is perhaps best viewed as a response to the spare capacity that's built up in the labour market over time. And if wage growth had not been as responsive as it has, it's likely that employment would have been less and the unemployment rate higher than we'd seen. So even though low wage growth works to constrain the growth of incomes for those who have a job, who are employed, it also supports income, labour income, by encouraging more employment than would otherwise be the case. Compositional change. Let me just say a few words about that. The outlook for the labour market will also depend on the composition of future labour demand. Now, when we look for signs of a turnaround in economic activity, much attention is often focused on the tangible things, the things that are easy to see, easy to measure more readily, the goods we produce and consume, the machinery, the buildings and infrastructure in which we invest. Yet a large and increasing share of our economic activity consists of services that we provide, the services we use, the services we enjoy, as well as the investment in intangible capital, and one important one of those is human capital. About half of us are now employed in the service industries. That's increased. It's up from about 45% 2 decades ago. But as the graphs I've just shown you suggested, over the past 3 years, the additional workers employed in the services industries have outnumbered the extra workers employed in goods by a factor of 5 to 1. 350,000 compared to about 75,000. That's the order of magnitude. So those employed in services, as I said, require relatively less capital to work with than workers employed in the goods sector. And as I mentioned, while some of the recent improvement in the services sector is likely to be part of a longer running trend, I think part of it may also be cyclical. And signals from the various business surveys, the sort of thing I just showed you, the ABS labour force and the vacancies data, those things can provide a timely guide as to the health of the increasingly important services sector. And finally, that leads me back to the issue of measurement, output and productivity in the services sector is more difficult to measure than it is for goods, the goods sector. But with services becoming increasingly large share of the economy, finding better ways to measure the contribution of services to the economy in real terms, the quantum that it adds to growth, that's going to become increasingly important in understanding our performance. And the key issue is that improvements in the quality of services, those things are very hard to measure, but these are important sources of improvement in our well-being. So let me just draw a few conclusions. In summary, so the economy has been adjusting to these various headwinds it's faced in recent years, and even though measured GDP growth has remained moderate over the past year or so, the unemployment rate appears to have stabilised and demand for labour looks to have picked up. And flexibility in labour markets, I think that's played a key role in these adjustments. One aspect of that has been some change in the growth of the labour supply via changes in the extent of immigration. Another aspect has been the adjustment has been the very low growth of wages, which has helped to support a pickup in employment growth. The improvement in labour demand, that's consistent with the rise in consumption growth, in strong dwelling investment, and an increasing contribution to GDP from net service exports. It's also apparent in improvements in survey measures of business conditions, in the ABS survey of vacancies, and employment in the services sector. And while this, I'll be the first to emphasise that there's uncertainty around our forecasts, including because of the usual noise that we see in the data, these developments suggest there'll be a slightly less spare capacity in the labour market than earlier we had anticipated. And in particular, we expect the unemployment rate to be little changed from recent levels over the next 18 months or so before declining in 2017. So let me finish it there and turn over to questions.
My question is about the implication of that low level of wages growth.
Mm-hmm.
That you have, usually wages growth leads core inflation. So if you've got wages growth at the lower end of the registered scale, shouldn't that suggest that sometime in coming months we should have a further fall in core inflation to maybe 2% or lower, something like that? Is that possible?
Well, by itself, that's what you'd expect, that low wage growth is helping to constrain domestic cost pressures. And you do see that in the data. You see it particularly in the elements of the CPI that have a very high labour content, things like market services. At the same time, though, what we've seen is the exchange rate has been depreciating over the past couple of years, and that tends to take quite some time before it fully passes through to the final prices that consumers see on the shelf, so to speak, the final prices they face. So we've seen those that depreciation affect import prices across the docks. The costs of goods and services that we import have gone up in Australian dollar terms, commensurate with that depreciation. But it takes a little while for those sort of prices to finally move all the way through to the final prices that consumers face. So we've got these two offsetting things. We've got these low domestic wage growth, well-contained domestic cost pressures, but gradually in our forecasts at least, further pass-through still of the coming from the depreciation of the exchange rate. So those traded, non-traded inflation components are sort of having an offsetting effect, if you like, and at least by our forecasts, likely to keep underlying inflation sort of towards the middle of the inflation target.
Thank you for that. Just leading on from that question, Mark. So, are we seeing you know, a shift, downward shift in potential GDP growth, and now we're seeing a shift towards a higher. Neither as a result of
the lower population growth?
Well, you know, we've outlined in our recent statement that we do think the, at least in the near term, the next couple of years, if our assumptions are right about population growth, and they could well be wrong, but though we've made those assumptions that it's going to be a bit lower than we had previously thought, then yes, the labour supply, the implication is other things equal, labour supply growing a bit less rapidly. And for an unchanged labour productivity growth, that means the productive capacity of the economy is slightly less. But it's a pretty small sort of revision in the scheme of the uncertainty that we have about the economy, which we always illustrate with these wide bands around those sort of central forecasts, whether it's GDP, whether it's unemployment, or whether it's inflation. But the implication of lower population growth is slightly lower growth of potential or sort of capacity, productive capacity. In terms of the implications for the Nauru, I think it's too early to draw much of a conclusion about that. I mean, the main thing is unemployment, though it hasn't increased as much as we might have earlier thought, it's still very high, and it's still having this effect on wage growth. So clearly there's a lot of spare capacity in the labour market.
Julian Pearce, you talked about compositional changes being quite important. One aspect that perhaps I'd interested in you drawing out a bit more is the shift between part-time and full-time employment, with the ABS's definition of what it means to be employed being quite generous, albeit in line with international practice. So is some of what we're seeing in terms of the trends in employment driven by a shift towards part-time employment that's more pronounced than the longer-term trend?
Well, the thing I would emphasise is that there is a longer-term trend towards more part-time employment. That's to be expected. I think it's a consistent sort of development across the globe, really. It's people expressing a preference to have part-time work and managing to find opportunities to do that. As you said, the ABS measurement is just to follow international best practice. I think that's important. It helps make our statistics sort of comparable across the globe. There's there's a slightly cyclical element perhaps to it, but it's not specific necessarily to the sort of part-time, full-time mix. There are people who would like to work more hours, and the ABS do those surveys, and those normally increase along with the aggregate level of the unemployment rate. So that's been happening, but I think that's probably affecting labour right across the spectrum, not all just on the part-time sort of split.
Tom Nguyen from Griffith University. I've got a comment and a question, and both of them also relate to compositional issues like Julian Pearce just asked. So the comment first, you alluded to in your fourth possible explanation, Chris, that could well be that ABS will revise the statistics. But you also talked about how as more and more of the GDP is being shifted over to the services sector, at some point we'll have to think really hard about how do we measure output, value added in the services sector. Putting those two together, my comment is that even if the ABS doesn't revise in the near term, maybe we could think that the current moderate rate of growth in GDP is a bit of an understatement. So that's the comment. The question is about the household services, which really showed extraordinary growth compared with, say, business services and goods-related sector. I just wonder, what are we talking about here? Are these Mac workers? Are these baristas? Are these gardeners and cleaners? Or what? Because if there's this composition here, if really that's what we're talking about, then the shift from very highly paid miners to, you know, say the kind of workers that I've just listed would perhaps suggest that overall we would see moderation in wage growth rather than really moderation in wage growth for each of the line or industry. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. A good question. I may miss elements of that, so feel free to kind of remind me if I haven't got them all. Just let me start at the latter point in terms of the wage growth. The national accounts measure that I showed you has the compositional effect adjust, sort of incorporated in there. So if you have less workers in a high-paying industry such as mining and more in lower-paying industries, that measure will sort of capture that compositional effect on the average level of wages. One measure that tries to adjust for that and take out the compositional effect is the WPI, the Wage Price Index. But it shows us, it doesn't have quite the same long history. It doesn't go back to the early 1990s, so I couldn't use that. But it does show a very substantial reduction in wage growth in that as well. So it's happening within each industry. And you see that when you pull the industries apart, the wage growth has declined to relatively low levels across each industry. I would caution, though, it's certainly true that mining industry jobs are highly paid. That's not surprising because the miners are employed to use a lot of capital. So that's to be expected. But it's not true that all service jobs are low paying. A lot of the growth is in very well paying jobs, including in healthcare, including in education. I mean, part of the issue is that as we become an economy that's more reliant on services, even though the service industries on average don't use as much physical capital, they still use a lot of intangible capital, and a lot of human capital is just as important, including in some of the very highly paid business service jobs. And so that's going to require a lot, maybe more energy devoted towards education than in the past, and education is quite the growth industry, I think, not just because of exporting our education services to foreigners. And those can be reasonably well-paid jobs as well. So it's a bit of... I wouldn't characterise, you know, we're moving to services and those are low-paid. They're not. Many service jobs are paid above jobs in the goods sector.
Quite a few economists looking at the statement on monetary policy that was released last Friday took the fact that you're not expecting unemployment to fall until 2017 as a signal perhaps that monetary policy is likely to stay fairly steady. How accurate would you characterise that?
The interest rate question. Well, I think the thing we have said is the thing we've said about interest rates, well, more about the outlook, is that the board, as it usually does, will sort of continue to keep an open mind, look at the data from month to month, see how things evolve. And the point I'd emphasise is come back to that point I made about uncertainty. There's a lot of uncertainty. And there's a whole industry that is out there trying to predict what it is that might happen to interest rates, financial market prices. That's understandable. That's warranted. That's useful. But we're not in that job. We don't have to do that. The board can, if it feels the strong need to signal something, can do that. But what I think we've said is that the board will keep an open mind, look at how things evolve. Our forecasts might deviate from what we've said. There's a slightly positive story to the recent data, but the economy is still growing at a moderate pace. Unemployment rate is still very high. There are lots of these very big headwinds that the economy faces, these challenges. So, you know, we'll just have to wait and see.
I think Christopher Kent has given us his tongue flesh, but I reckon we have time for one more.
Oh, for sure.
Mark Ludlow from the Financial Review. Just back on economic growth, can you outline what will be the impact on governments if it's true that the economy is growing at a slower rate than first thought? And do you believe that the 3.5% economic growth rate is no longer realistic?
Well, I'd say two let me say two things. The first is we've just made our best guess, an assumption, if you like, about population growth based on the recent data that we've seen, and the fact that it's understandable that population growth has eased back a bit from quite strong levels to something not quite as strong, but still population growth of 1.4%. It's not too far off the historical average. But that could turn again. And it makes sense that it's a bit low if our labour market conditions have weakened to a degree while they've improved elsewhere in the world. That makes a lot of sense. But our labour market conditions can change, and they can change elsewhere. And so that could turn around. So it's not a prediction that I think you could count on for a long period of time. We've just made the best assumption we can. In terms of sort of what does it mean for state and fiscal finances, well, the thing I'd emphasise is those might have to respond to changes in population growth, either population much stronger from here or weaker still or lower than it has been in the past. But it affects both revenue and it affects their expenditure as well over time. And it's just like it affects the growth of the aggregate demand in the economy and the aggregate supply. So in terms of the balance, it doesn't necessarily have any strong implications because it's going to be affecting both sides of that. Of course, if you're an economy in Europe or in Japan which has very high public debt and you've got less growth in the population to generate revenue to service that public debt, well, that makes life harder. But we don't have especially high public debt as a share of GDP, either at state or federal levels. Thank you.